Okay, would everyone please turn in your Bibles to the book of Daniel. Book of Daniel. And we've titled the book Survival. And tonight we're focusing upon God and His sovereignty over all things. And Lord willing, in part two, this is part one, in part two we'll look at particularly at Daniel himself and survival for him personally in the exile. And kind of as a general broad outline, in chapters 1 through 6, we have six stories of individual survival in the book of Daniel. And then chapters 7 through 12, there are visions Daniel has that God has given him of future corporate deliverance. Corporate meaning collectively for the people, God's people. That his people collectively will be delivered by God. So kind of a first topic here to look at just is changing kings. Before we delve into it, just remember Daniel here, he is exiled in Babylon. Ezekiel, book of Ezekiel we just finished, he himself was also exiled when he had his visions. And God, in other words, is communicating to both Ezekiel and Daniel in Babylon, in exile. So God's going with his people when he left, when he pulled his glory from Jerusalem. And remember, Jeremiah was the one who was in Jerusalem when it fell to the Babylonians in 587 BC. Well, we think about changing kings. And we're thinking, in particular, you think of Augustine's. Augustine, the city of God and the kingdom of men, that God's kingdom is one that endures forever. God's reign and rule. And his kingdom is one that's permanent and fixed. But all earthly kingdoms fall. They all have a timetable. And that goes for the United States of America. And it goes for every earthly nation. The clock is ticking for every earthly empire and every earthly nation. And in particular, we see several in Daniel, in this historical story that plays out in his life. So the story of Daniel is set against the backdrop of the glorious rebirth of Babylon under King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I'm not going to keep writing that name, so I put N. for Nebuchadnezzar on the board, because that's a pretty long name, right? So, but it's set in that backdrop. So Babylon had a glorious rebirth into the world's power under King Nebuchadnezzar in the 6th century B.C. So in the 6th century B.C., we're saying in the 500s. 500s B.C. And Jerusalem fell in 587. And under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire reached its largest size that it would ever be. It was the most powerful that it would ever be under Nebuchadnezzar. Babylon, the city, was rebuilt into the greatest city of the ancient world. Look at chapter 4 of Daniel, verse 30. King spoke, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" And he's referring at that time to the greatest city in the world at that time. And And he built it in his mind. Notice it's my mighty power for his own majesty. But he has it in his mind. He's the one that pridefully could say that he built it. It is the largest archaeological site in ancient Mesopotamia, in that region of the world. The archaeological site is over 2,000 acres in size. It's kind of interesting. So out of the whole ancient world, this is the largest archaeological site where they're digging and finding the remains of what's left that's been buried underground from Babylon. It's over 2,000 acres in size. The wall was that big and wide and big. And if I recall from my forestry days, a long time ago, but I think 164 acres is 1 mile by 1 mile. So you think that's quite a few miles wide and long. Pretty big city. Chapter 1, verse 2. Look at chapter 1, verse 2. We'll read verse 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it, attacked it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, small g, of his idol. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God, small g. And there was at that time, we referred to this several times going through the historical books in the Old Testament, that small g here, gods of conquered nations were deemed inferior. So that was the idea, is if Babylon conquered any nation, their view was that whatever that other nation's was as their god is inferior to the idols of Babylon. So Babylon regarded then Yahweh as inferior, taking those articles back, plugging it into his own idol temple. Okay, keep that in the back of your mind also when you're thinking about what's going to happen. Great kings come and go. That's one of the, we're looking at the big themes and the big picture in these books in the Old Testament. And that's something that comes out when you read Daniel, that kings come and go, and great kings come and go. Powerful kings come and go. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC, and he was followed by Belshazzar. Darius the Mede followed Belshazzar, and then Cyrus the Persian followed Darius the Mede. When you read Isaiah 40, it says, like God merely blows on them and they wither and fade. In fact, turn to Isaiah 40. I like that section. Look at verse 23, 24. God is he. He brings the princes to nothing. Isaiah 40, 23. God brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stalk take root in the earth when he will also blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. Yes, God is sovereign over the princes and rulers and kings of the earth. They're presented as, in horticultural terms, as being planted, sown, taking snot. They grow, and God merely blows on them, and they wither. They die, and on to the next king. Back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. Now I'll say we're going to spend more time when we focus on Daniel and his own survival. But we're focusing here on changing kings. Okay, and the theme of changing kings now in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a large statue of a man built with different materials, which then crumbles when struck by a rock. Now God gives Daniel the dream and its interpretation, what it means, and then each of the statue's materials, we learn that each of the statue's materials represent a different empire, a different kingdom, that God destroys, establishing his eternal kingdom. Look at chapter 2, verse 27. Let me read here, 27 and following, where Daniel explains the meaning of his dream. Daniel 2, verses 27 and following. Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. None of them knew what it meant. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the later days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be." Remember the secret will of God, the decreed will of God? God works all things after the counsel of his will. Ephesians 1:11, that's the idea here. He's decreed the future and what will be. "But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." Remember that phrase there, that's important. "Then the iron and the clay, the bronze and the silver and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors." There again, in horticultural terms. "The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, of the beasts of the field and of the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are his head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything, and like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Now, other visions are also given. You see visions of great beasts in chapter 7, and a ram and a goat, a vision of a ram and a goat in chapter 8. And they all represent earthly kingdoms that rise and fall. And if you look at chapter 8, verse 25, look at the very last phrase of chapter 8, verse 25. Referring to this kingdom here, but he shall be broken without human means. And if you look at the footnote B at the bottom there, literally that means hand, or hands. Literally in the Hebrew it means that he shall be broken without human hands by God's doing. Well, these visions, also of chapter 10, 11, and 12, also teach this, that each one will be end without, by an event that God's doing. It won't be by human hands. That all kingdoms, all nations, which are human and earthly only, have an end in this world, and that the true and living God in heaven brings about that end. Okay, that's a theme that's here in Daniel. That God reigns and rules. Nations are always judged in this world, in this time and realm. And because we're dealing with sinners, all nations come to an end in this world except God. Okay, let me flip the board over. Kind of the next heading here is God unchanging. God unchanging. Look at chapter 2, verses 20 to 23. Chapter 2, verses 20 to 23. Now look at verse 19. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. So this is Daniel's prayer here. After God reveals Nebuchadnezzar's dream in it, meaning Daniel prays. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven. In verse 20, Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his, and he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings." That's a theme of the book of Daniel. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. "I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might. You have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand. But God is the one who removes kings and raises up kings." Daniel 2:21. Look at chapter 2 there. Continue in verse 34, 44, and 45. Which I read at that section of. It said, take note of verse 34, chapter 2, verse 34, "You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces." And then look at verse 45, "Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold." And this is what God will do. And notice verse 44. And in those days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And twice there, Daniel says, God cut a stone, it's not cut by human hand, and destroyed each kingdom. And then we read chapter 2, verses 37 and 38. Where Daniel celebrates Nebuchadnezzar's sovereignty as a gift from a greater sovereign. And that greater sovereign is God. Chapter 2, verse 37 and 38. You, O king, are a king of kings. This is Nebuchadnezzar. You've defeated many other kings. So you are a king of kings, Nebuchadnezzar. For the God of heaven has given you, it's a gift. Right? God raises up kings. Right? Isn't that what Daniel prayed in Daniel 2:21? That God removes kings and raises up kings? So here he says, the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heaven, he, God, has given them into your hand, and has made you ruler over them all. We find this is the same in the New Covenant. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, and it is true in our day. You see that in Romans 13, verse 1. The last half of that verse, where the Apostle Paul wrote, "For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God." God is the one who removes kings and raises up kings. There is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. And you can say, well, we vote for president. We do. But God's the one who's ultimately in charge. And he gets exactly who he wants in power. There's a lot of events that take place that shape people's opinion on who to vote for. And God in his providence is over all of the circumstances, all of the debates they have, all of the mistakes they make, all of the smiling providences they have in their campaigns. And throughout all those circumstances, God is preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions in his providence, and he gets exactly what he wants to shape everyone's opinion to vote for the particular president he wants elected. Look at chapter 2, 46 to 47. Here we see three things that are interesting. This is the first of three. Chapter 2, verse 46. Then Nebuchadnezzar, after being told the meaning of the dream, of this big statue and all the different materials it was made of, what it represented, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." So we see that Nebuchadnezzar acknowledges God. Okay? And as we'll see, this is the first of three times here that he does this. Something that stands out in Daniel. We're looking for the things that stand out when you fly over the book. How about chapter 3, verse 29? Now, I want to point something out here. Before we look at 3:29, his acknowledgement of God here, it's the first of three. It's words, right? He acknowledged God. What did he say to Daniel in chapter 2, verse 47? "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords." He's a revealer of secrets. He acknowledges God. But note, what does he do right there at the beginning of chapter 3? He has this big statue built and says, "Everyone needs to worship me." Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, chapter 3, verse 1, whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And what does he want? He wants everyone to bow down and worship that image. Look at the end of verse 5, chapter 3. You shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. So his acknowledgement is cheap. That's my point. In chapter 2, verse 47, right? It's just words. Because we see his actions, he puts up this big statue and said, hey, it's a statue of me, worship me. Idolatry. So then what do we see then? We see that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not bow down. Right? Three Hebrew men are saved. They're put in the fiery furnace, though. They didn't bow down. They didn't worship this statue. They didn't commit idolatry. Three Hebrew men are saved, though, in the fiery furnace. God saves them. But what do we see again? Chapter 3, verse 29. Let's start in verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies, that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Right? He wanted them to commit idolatry to himself. Therefore, I will make a decree that any people, nation, or language that speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. So here he is again, acknowledging God. Second time. And then we have Nebuchadnezzar recounting a whole story of his dreams here in chapter 4, in the sense of his second dream. I'll just read a few verses at the beginning of chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar the king, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. His dominion is from generation to generation, etc., etc. And he goes to explain that there were visions in my head while on my bed. Verse 10. These were visions of my head while in bed. Well, look at verse 17. Where he goes on here. This decision is by the decree of watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whoever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So again, he acknowledges God. This is the third time. Yeah. When he makes this declaration of these other, his story of his dreams in chapter 4. But what's clear is that he's still a proud man. Okay, he's making these declarations. We see that it's basically just words, right? Because in the middle of it, he makes the statue to himself and wants people to worship himself, this image of himself. So chapter 4, verses 23 to 26. Look at chapter 4, verses 23 to 26. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. This is where Daniel's explaining the meaning of his dream. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation. In other words, this is the meaning, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, meaning of God in heaven, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven, meaning God in heaven, rules. So Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar that he would be humbled. In fact, he's going to be humbled where he's going to be made mad. He's going to lose his mind and eat, be like an animal, eating, grazing grass like the ox. And he's not going to be restored until he truly accepts in his heart that God rules. That it's not just words, but he really, truly, in his heart, knows and believes and trusts and treasures that God in heaven rules and reigns. Look at what happened there, chapter 4, 28 to 33. And all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of the 12 months. 12 months later, he was walking around about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling in my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" He's still self-centered, proudful, thinking about himself. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven. "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses." That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. What do we see then in chapter 4, 34, 35? "At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say to him, 'What have you done?'" Let me keep reading. "At the same time, my reason returned to me," which is similar to the prodigal son in the stooped in the pig's mire, that his mind and reason came back to him. Like, what am I doing? "At the same time, my reason returned to me, for the glory of my kingdom, my honor, my splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his way is justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down." So even though he had acknowledged God at least three times prior, he was still proudful and walking in pride in his heart, and God dealt with him and humbled him and showed him that God is the one who reigns and rules. Think of it this way. This is another way. John Piper thinks of it this way. Is your Bible is the window. You're looking out the window, right, of the building. You're looking through the window out into the majesty of God. And through this window, God has revealed to us this is who he is. And this is some of the great mountaintops of who God is, of his majesty, his glory, his dominion. And he reigns and rules. Nebuchadnezzar was the most powerful human being on earth at that time, in the most powerful city of the most powerful kingdom. And God's saying, "I merely blow on him and he withers and fades. I am the one who takes down kings and lifts up kings. God is saying, I am the one that does whatever I please in heaven. No one can ward off my hand. No one can stop me or say, what have you done? God is just, because he's dealing with sinful people who don't deserve anything. And anyone who walks in pride, he is able to put down and humble, which is a warning for every one of us. It is not by our own might that we do anything, technically. Ultimately, it is by God's grace that things are achieved in our life. We've accomplished things, but we must give him credit and give him honor. How about the... It is a good verse. It's similar to me to Deuteronomy 8, verse 2 and verse 16. That God sent Israel, after redeeming them out of Egypt, he sent them into the wilderness to test them and humble them. And he'll do it with every one of us. Every one of us, which is why we can put our name there. Because every one of us has this sinful pride. We're born spiritually dead in Adam. And when God regenerates us, sin no longer reigns, sin no longer rules our life, but it still remains, and we still have this sinful pride, and God's got to knock that down. And his works are truth, and his ways justice. He commits no injustice when he humbles us, because we're sinners. You know, yeah, and that is certainly true, from the greater to the lesser. This was the most powerful human being on the planet. And God did that to him. He lost his mind. He ate grass like an animal. His hair looked like feathers of an eagle. Got long claws on his nails. Nothing was kept. He was an animal. Totally mad, like an unreasoning animal. If God can do that to him, he can do it to any one of us like that. God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. It's a central theme, and that's the first mark of a Christian's humility. That we know everything is a gift of God. Every good thing and perfect thing is a gift from the Father of Lights, James 1:17. Everything. He will exalt you at the proper time. Now, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. And again, our passion in life should be God's glory, right? Whether we eat, whether we drink, whatever we do, to do it to God's glory, right? 1 Corinthians 10:31, which means this is my delight, to put myself and say, I want to be humble. Why? Because I want God to be lifted up. I want him to be glorified. I want him to get credit for everything I have, for all the accomplishments, any wealth, any achievements in education, anything I ever do that's anything's good. Ultimately, I want to say, Lord, it's your grace. You're the one that raised me up. You can lift me down and you can raise me up, and it's by your grace that I've done anything good. Right? We've quoted John 15:5. Apart from him, we can do nothing. But our glory is our delight and our passion. It brings us joy. How about Belshazzar? How about him? The next king. So we see these kings, right? Changing kings. And God unchanging. So chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Belshazzar became king, and he held a banquet for 1,000 nobles. That's a huge banquet, right? Big. Suddenly, a hand appears and writes something on the wall that no one can read. Okay, so let's read 5, 1 through 4. Belshazzar, the king, made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. These nobles, these... and drank wine in the presence of the 1,000. While he tasted the wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods, small g, these idols, of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Okay, now look over it. Verse 8. Now all the king's wise men came, and they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Okay, so later here in chapter 5, verses 17 to 23, Daniel tells Belshazzar he is found wanting and God will give his kingdom away. And then that very night, Belshazzar died. Let's read chapter 5, verses 17 to 23. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor." Right? Rule and kingdom is from God's hand. Right? He raises them up, he tears them down at God's will whenever he pleases. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, a kingdom and majesty, glory, and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whoever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, in other words, when he was prideful, and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he, God, chooses. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. Wow. He watched it. He saw it. He knew it all, but he didn't humble his heart. And you have lifted yourself up in simple pride against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the small g gods, the idols of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. That's worth underlining. God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And if that's true of Belshazzar, it's true of every one of us. God holds our breath in his hand and owns all our ways. And our responsibility is to glorify and give him credit for the weight of who he is as the ruler of heaven and earth, the one who preserves all his creatures and all their actions, to the most powerful king, to the lowliest person, to the smallest atom. verse 30, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom. Like that. One king deposed, another one raised. Chapter 6, we have jealous officials who set a legal trap. Jealous of Daniel. And they had a law, and Darius signed this law, that said you can only pray to King Darius. Daniel disobeys the law and is thrown into the lion's den. Okay, Lord willing, we'll look more at this in part 2. What do we see? Well, chapter 6, verse 26, Darius confesses. Look at that twice then. Darius confesses God's sovereignty after Daniel was removed unharmed from the lion's den the next day. So look at chapter 6, verse 26. Look at verse 26 and 27. I make a decree, King Darius here, after God preserved Daniel in the lion's den, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble in fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So here we have another one being brought to acknowledge God's sovereignty over all kings and kingdoms. So what can we say? That there's a theme then, you see, right? In this book. Every king originally believes he is all-powerful and that his kingdom will endure. And yet God helps each king realize that God's kingdom alone will endure. That's something we see in the book of Daniel as a theme. And he wants us to be reminded of it. And he's reminding Daniel and the exiles of it. Let's say, hey, yeah, I removed you from the promised land for your sin. But every king, even every powerful king in Babylon is over my, is in my control. I am over them. I tear them down, I raise them up at my will. We see in Daniel 7, 9 through 10, where Daniel gets a vision of the true throne room, God's throne room. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated and the books were opened. He's given a vision there of God's throne room in heaven, the Ancient of Days, of the one whose dominion is forever and ever. His kingdom cannot be destroyed. We'll look more at that, Lord willing, in part 2. Look at chapter 11, verse 36. Daniel sees a future king who will finally cause God to usher in the end of human history. The final and worst sovereign, final and worst king, will also learn of God's authority. There's this picture that there's coming, even one at the end of time, who will be the very worst of earthly human kings, whom God will also teach, as he taught Nebuchadnezzar, as he taught Belshazzar, as he taught Darius, as he teaches each king, that this future terrible evil king, this terrible evil sovereign, will also learn of God's authority. Look at chapter 11:36. That this king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, small g, above every idol, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. So this last king in human history is going to be very, very bad. And look at verse 45 of chapter 11. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. His also will be ended by God, the true and living God who reigns in heaven. Verse 12, I'll read 1 through 3. At that time, Michael shall stand up, Michael the archangel, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. We're talking about the end of times, eschatology, and where God's kingdom has no end. God's dominion is over all. And there is coming a judgment day. And everyone will face it. Some to everlasting life, those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. As the end of verse 1 says of chapter 12, everyone who's found written in the book. Which book? Lamb's Book of Life that we find in the book of Revelation. But those whose names are not written in there shall be judged according to their sinful works. Then some to shame and everlasting contempt. And they will be thrown into the lake of fire. God reigns and rules. And those who are sinfully proud, he abases and humbles. But it's great comfort to you and I. This is great comfort when we think about it all. God's in control. Proverbs 21:1, he turns the king's heart like channels of water in his hand, whithersoever he will. God's in control. No matter who wins this fall's election, we know God's in control. He raises rulers and he brings rulers down. The true and living God rules. And we humbly serve him. And he is for our good in all things. The one who reigns and rules over the most powerful people on the human planet right now has promised to work all things together for our good to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Everything. Even some of the things that will bring tears to our eyes, he is working for our good in Christ Jesus, to his glory. Lord willing, we'll pick it up and ponder Daniel's survival during this whole time. Pastor Ron?